listening to Zuluk and the tune Soul Rebel Dub. Before this, Double Standard with the tune Dub Mental Knee Fixed Fitness from Bass for a Nervous Planet. And that's about it for me for today. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm DJ Firefly. If you missed the show or you want to get in touch with me, feel free to check out my website at djfirefly.com.
Reynolds, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we uncover how our most personal data, our DNA, is being collected and stored by the Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection.
We speak with Stevie Glaberson from Georgetown Center on Privacy and Technology about the scale, legality, and consequences of this growing surveillance system.
We also speak with best-selling author Sarah Kendzior about her article Inventing Antifa.
She explains how an armed forces group called Akromia allegedly gave orders for a massacre in Uzbekistan. The only problem, the organization didn't exist. We'll hear parallels between Donald Trump and his henchmen in our own country. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
Worldwide, governments are quietly stockpiling one of the most intimate forms of personal data imaginable, our DNA. What began as a tool for identifying suspects and reuniting families has become a global infrastructure for surveillance, an invisible archive of our genetic code, stored and searchable. In 2024, Georgetown Law's Center on Privacy and Technology sounded the alarm in a report titled Raiding the Genome, How the United States Government is Abusing Its Immigration Powers to Amass DNA for Future Policing. The findings were stark. U.S. immigration authorities are collecting DNA on a massive scale, far beyond what the law permits. In a follow-up report last month, the center reveals that Customs and Border Protection is taking DNA from American citizens, too, routinely, without consent, and without oversight, then funneling those samples to the FBI. Once there, they're added to the National Criminal Database, known as CODIS, where law enforcement agencies nationally can access and search them. We're joined today by Stevie Glaberson, Director of Research and Advocacy for the Center, and an author of the report. She joined the Center after serving as a visiting professor and the director of Georgetown Law's Civil Litigation Clinic, which she helped found as a clinical teaching fellow and a staff attorney. Stevie, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stevie, where did the Center on Privacy and Technology get its data for this report? And how confident are you in its accuracy?
Yeah, so our center has been engaged in research about DHS's expanding DNA collection program for a number of years. And so we spent a lot of time looking at the law, looking at the regulations, talking to folks. on the front lines, at the border. And as part of that, we also submitted a number of Freedom of Information Act requests to the government. And one of them we did in partnership with the Amica Center for Immigrant Rights and Americans for Immigrant Justice. And we asked for a bunch of things, lots of stuff about the DNA program. So in particular, we asked for records reflecting the locations where DNA was being collected and demographic makeup of the individuals whose DNA was collected under this rule. And largely, the government has failed to respond to that request, and we are actually, that group, us and Amica Center and AIJ, are suing the government over the rest of that request. But we did get one thing, which was a massive set of spreadsheets from CBP only. So we made these requests of CBP and of ICE. And CBP only provided us a bunch of spreadsheets that seemed to show everyone from whom that agency collected DNA from 2020 to 2024, so under the Biden administration, and sent that DNA to the FBI for addition to CODIS. That's where, in terms of the granular data information about U.S. citizens being in this data set, that's where we got it from. And I think your question also asked about accuracy. And, you know, this is the government's own data. So on the one hand, it only shows what the government wrote down. So we have to take that with a grain of salt. But the government here is doing something really, really big, taking people's genetic material, adding it to a criminal policing database. And so we would hope that they are recording correctly what they're doing. Whether they are is a really big question.
How is the DNA actually gathered? Do they swab people?
Yeah, that's our understanding, that they are using buccal swabs of people's cheeks. So having people open their mouths, putting something into their mouth, and taking cells of their cheeks. And what's really important to know about that is that what comes out of a buccal swab, what comes out of that kind of a DNA swab, is someone's entire genetic code. So it's not some sanitized profile that gets created later, but it is pure genetic material, a piece of this person's body.
Stevie, this is a chilling story. I'm sitting here shocked, really. Tell us more about the individuals whose DNA was taken. How many cases are we talking about? Where were they when it happened? And are any of them, or how many of them, are U.S. citizens?
Yeah. So in total, in the first 5 years of the explosion of this program, DHS has added more than 2.6 million people's DNA to our country's criminal policing database, what's called CODIS. We have reason to believe that obviously has not stopped, and it's now topping more than 3 million. So there's 3 million more people today than there were in 2020 in this database, all added by DHS. We don't completely know how many of those came from border interactions versus interactions in the interior. The information we got from CBP is a little hard to parse. They removed identifying information for these folks, but it's also hard to tell what data pertains back to one individual. So we had to do some analysis and try to figure out how many people are really represented in this data. Our best guess is that CBP, the agency that mostly operates on the border, is responsible for about 1.3 million or more of those who've been added to CODIS, and that leaves about a million or more that may have come from ICE encounters. But like I said, we have not been able to get information from ICE in the same way. And as far as U.S. citizens, we saw when we analyzed the data, there are about 2,000 U.S. citizens that CBP has said in its own documents that it has taken their DNA and sent it to CODIS. And in many, many of those cases, the CBP agents written down to try to justify taking that person's DNA either was altogether missing. There's absolutely no justification for, I think, 40 of those folks. But for the ones where there's anything written down, those justifications are often legally questionable or nonsensical. But what's really important to understand is none are subject to independent review. So I'll note, this is not just happening at the border. It clearly is happening in large measure at the border. But one thing listeners should be aware of is that the border is maybe not what they always think of. Like, we have examples of people coming through Chicago Midway Airport, through Detroit Airport. So a huge number of folks are having this happen when they're crossing the border, but our understanding is that ICE is also conducting DNA collection, and that this is happening in the interior as well.
The Fourth Amendment protects us from unreasonable searches and seizures. Does collecting someone's DNA normally require a warrant? And if so, how is the government justifying these warrantless extractions?
Yeah, so that's right. These are warrantless searches. There is basically no question that these are searches under the Fourth Amendment. And there are really two important constitutional concerns that we have with this program. And the first is what checks are in place to ensure that the government isn't abusing its power. It's a really important question when it comes to Fourth Amendment, whether something comports with the Fourth Amendment. And also what the government's justification is for this search or intrusion. So if you'll stick with me for a second, I want to talk about each of those things because it's not entirely intuitive and really important to understand when it comes to government DNA collection. And on neither of these measures does DHS's DNA collection program pass constitutional muster. So first is the question of checks, and this is usually where a warrant comes into place. A warrant is important because it represents a judge, someone outside of the chain of command, of the authority of the agency, who's come in and looked at what the government, what the executive agency is trying to do, what the policing agent is trying to do, and said, yep, you have enough suspicion, you have enough evidence that it makes sense in this case to do this search or to seize this person. So there's an important case, the most recent case from the Supreme Court, talking about the legality, the constitutionality of DNA collection, compulsory government DNA collection, and it's called Maryland versus King. And in that case, the court said that a warrantless DNA collection was okay when it was based on an arrest, a criminal arrest, based on a finding of probable cause that the person committed a serious crime. So that's the latest statement we have from the Supreme Court, and that's a really important thing to pay attention to, because when the Supreme Court last said that compulsory warrantless DNA collection was okay, it was only in that circumstance of after an arrest based on a finding of probable cause that the person committed a serious crime. What DHS is doing is not that. So first, the law limits DHS to collecting DNA only from people it detains, but detention is not an arrest based on probable cause. DHS agents detain people in practice on a wide variety of standards, from probable cause down to mere suspicion or even no suspicion at all. But most importantly, there is no one checking whether DHS agents in their exercise of this detention power are actually justified when they're making these stops. And, you know, we have, I think, Scalia saying that the point of the Fourth Amendment is that it ensures the justification for a search or a seizure is evaluated for its sufficiency by a neutral and detached magistrate instead of being judged by the officer. The quote is, the officer engaged in the often competitive enterprise of ferreting out crime. So the idea is that the agent whose job it is to arrest or detain people can't have judgment about whether he or she is doing that, you know, comporting with constitutional standards when doing that competitive enterprise. So that's why we put neutral judges in the mix. But there is no neutral party like that when it comes to an immigration detention. And I also think it's important for listeners to understand that when we say detention, we don't mean necessarily someone being held for a lengthy period in a camp or a jail, although that certainly is a detention. The government has even said, with regard to this DNA stuff, that even just a brief holdup can be enough of a detention to warrant DNA collection. So that's the issue of there being no checks, but there's also this issue of what the government's justification is for conducting this search. And we go back again to Maryland versus King, which talked at length about Maryland's justification in its program that it was that the court was assessing. And that case really turned on the judges relied on the state's claimed limited purpose, not of crime solving, but of, it said, identifying those in its custody. I'm not often in the position of quoting this much from Justice Scalia, but Scalia, again, in his dissent in that case, said, "The Fourth Amendment forbids searching a person for evidence of a crime when there is no basis for believing the person is guilty of the crime or in possession of incriminating evidence. That prohibition is categorical and without exception. It lies at the very heart of the Fourth Amendment." So the idea that the government can just, because people are interacting with immigration agents, search them for evidence of crimes for which they have no suspicion, that's not acceptable under the Fourth Amendment. But in Maryland versus King, Maryland had offered this other justification, this, like, we need to identify the people in our custody. And as, again, Scalia said, that justification really taxes the credulity of the credulous. It doesn't really pass muster, but nevertheless, the court accepted it and relied on it. And we see the government here, the DHS and DOJ, relying on that same, like, wrapping themselves in King. And in the only justification they've put out, there are some documents in relation to the new rule that kicked all this off in 2020. They just cited to Maryland versus King over and over again saying, yeah, nothing to see here. Our only interest here is in identifying people. But then also, you know, said the quiet part out loud and added a fifth justification saying that they wanted the DNA to, quote, further the fundamental objectives of the criminal justice system. So we really have a lot of reasons to question what DHS is doing, why they think they want this DNA in the first place. But ultimately what happens with this DNA is that a profile gets made and it gets added to CODIS, the criminal policing database, and it's used just for regular crime solving. That's not a reason to do this kind of sweeping, suspicionless, massive collection of some of the most sensitive data, information, parts of people's bodies that we're seeing here.
Stevie, you mentioned CODIS, the FBI National DNA Database. For those who are unfamiliar, what exactly is CODIS and what does it mean if someone's DNA ends up there? Can it ever be removed?
Yeah, so CODIS stands for the Combined DNA Index System. It is an FBI-administered database of DNA profiles. And I think CODIS is actually the software, and there are these layered databases that are called NDIS, LDIS, SDIS, which stands for National DNA Index System, local, state. So there are various levels to this, but what DHS is sending to the FBI is getting added at the national level. And law enforcement from any of those levels, national, state, local, can search against what's known as like the known person database, people like those that we're talking about here, where the government already knows their identity and has added them to the database in future criminal investigations. You asked about whether there's a way to get your data out of the system. So I guess there's two things to think about. One is the profile that's in CODIS. And I also mentioned that the physical sample, the cells that came out of that person's cheek, the government also has that. And our understanding is they keep it in perpetuity. And there doesn't seem to be a system for purging it. They say they keep it for quality assurance, but we have a lot of questions about what that means. As far as a profile in CODIS, there should be a way under the law, if you can prove that your DNA shouldn't be there, to get it out. But we have now, through multiple FOIA requests and like 2 years, been trying to get a better understanding of whether that's at all possible in these immigration situations. And we are no further along. We have no evidence that there is like a real process or that anyone has tried and succeeded to get their DNA out. And I guess I'll also mention that with this massive expansion of DNA, of DNA collection at DHS, DHS is now the primary contributor to CODIS.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Heidi Bogosian. My co-host Stephen Rohde and I are speaking with Stevie Glaberson, the Director of Research and Advocacy for the Georgetown Center on Technology and Privacy. Stevie, oversight, or the lack thereof, seems to be a recurring theme. Did your team uncover accountability gaps? And which agencies should be keeping this program in check, but are not?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen over and over again in this research and other, many other places, that DHS is incapable of policing itself. But that's so often what it's allowed to do. As I've described, there are just no checks built into the system. There's no one outside of the DHS structure that is, in every case, checking that DHS is exercising this incredibly powerful DNA collection power appropriately. To get into CODIS, DHS has to send these DNA samples to the FBI, which then processes them and adds them to the database. We, after we discovered that there were all these U.S. citizens in the data that DHS sends to the FBI, we asked the FBI through a FOIA request, you know, what is your process for vetting the information you're getting from DHS? And they responded that they were unable to find any records responsive to our requests. So that does not inspire confidence that there's any kind of internal, or like within the executive, checks that this stuff is happening appropriately. Now, Congress can and should repeal this power. They created it and they can get rid of it. It's simply too much power to have in these unchecked hands. We've seen Senator Wyden, we've seen Representative Presley do some really strong questioning of the agency. We haven't seen this agency being responsive to those efforts, but we think Congress really needs to rethink this completely.
Beyond legality, there's a question of trust. What are the broader risks to privacy, civil liberties, community cooperation when the government normalizes collecting DNA without individualized suspicion or arrest?
Yeah, I mean, what we normalize with respect to vulnerable communities will spread. We've already seen that happen, just in the U.S. citizens already being swept up in this program, but also we've just gotten a new rule proposed by Trump's DHS to expand DNA and other biometric collection to anyone who applies for any type of immigration benefit, including children and, quote, associated U.S. citizens. The time is now to take action. If we want our DNA, which is the most sensitive information about us, not only us, but our families, everyone genetically related to us, to stay safe, we need to take action now, because this is an inflection point.
Stevie, your report, Rating the Genome, notes that after 2020, a surge occurred in DNA collection. Did something change policy, legally or technology-wise?
Yeah, so what changed is the first Trump administration changed the rules. So the law that gives immigration agents the authority to collect DNA was passed into law in 2005 as an amendment to the Bipartisan and Popular Violence Against Women Act, but it got little publicity at the time and no Democratic debate. But in the intervening years from 2005 to about 2020, there was a rule written into the implementing regulations by the agency that said that DHS could decide based on how it's on operational exigencies, on what it felt was important or useful to do, whether to build out a DNA collection program. And for all that time, DHS felt like, we don't really think it's worth it for immigration enforcement, so we're not going to do it. But in about 2018, the first Trump administration started to pay attention and rewrote the rules, taking away that discretion and flipping the regime on its head. In those first 15 years, DHS as an entity had added only about 28,000 profiles to CODIS with that power that it got from statute. After 2020, with the new rules and an emphasis on collecting DNA, we've seen that number just really skyrocket. The result is that the most consequential expansion of the government's DNA collection power since the advent of CODIS has occurred without meaningful democratic debate.
Looking ahead, Stevie, how might this kind of genetic surveillance intersect with emerging technologies like AI-driven profiling, facial recognition, or predictive policing?
Yeah, I mean, we're already seeing law enforcement and DHS in particular continue to buy and build technological systems to link up records across systems and build comprehensive dynamic dossiers on all of us. We're also seeing law enforcement entities experiment with these unreliable technologies, like daisy-chaining them together with each other. There's a technology that's being sold to police forces using that purports to be able to use DNA to build a face, and then police will run that face that's now been created out of whole cloth, basically, through face recognition technologies. And this is just layering the unreliable on the speculative to and using its results to direct these militarized forces against us.
Stevie, on a personal note, what can our listeners do to protect themselves and their families? And do they have the right to say no, for example, at the airport when a representative wants to swab them? And also, where can they find your important reports, Rating the Genome and the more recent Rating the U.S. Citizen Genome, to learn more?
Actually, your point about whether you can refuse is a really important one, because we had a question about that, about how people are experiencing this. Because the situation in which most people are being confronted with the prospect of DNA collection is incredibly coercive and terrifying, and they really feel like at the mercy of the agents that are in front of them. And so we assumed that very few would refuse. The people we talked to and heard and whose stories we heard about either didn't know what was going on. Many thought that it was a COVID test or a swab for illness, because this all started right around the same time as COVID. And those that did understand were really afraid and too afraid to refuse. We did get a document back in FOIA that showed that not no one refused. I think about 170-something people did refuse, but we don't know what happened to them. You know, I think the best thing that people can do to protect themselves is learn more and ask questions. I will say all of our reports are available on our website. You can Google Georgetown Privacy and you'll get to us. We are the Center on Privacy and Technology. And if any of those U.S. citizens that appear in the data who had their DNA taken happen to be listening, we would love to talk to you, because we're thinking about what recourse you might have. So you can email us at privacy@georgetown.edu.
Stevie, this has been absolutely illuminating and, of course, terrifying. We want to thank you and the Center for your continued excellent work, and hope to have you on again in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
On October 18, No King's Day, in her popular newsletter, author Sarah Kendzior wrote a disturbing column entitled Inventing Antifa. It begins, quote, "In 2005, the Uzbek government invented a group called Akromia to justify a massacre of protesters. Now I worry the U.S. government will do the same," unquote. She recounted how on May 13, 2005, the Uzbek government killed over 700 civilians gathered in the eastern city of Andijan to protest the economic, social, and political conditions of Uzbekistan. Prompted by the imprisonment and subsequent jailbreak of popular local businessmen, the crowd grew to 10,000 people, some drawn by a rumor that their dictator, President Karimov, would address the largest protest in Uzbekistan's history. Instead, the military forces greeted the demonstrators. According to the Uzbek government, the forces targeted only armed insurgents, 187 of whom were killed. But according to nearly all other accounts, the military fired indiscriminately into the crowd, murdering at least 700 people, including children. At the center of the massacre was a group the Uzbek government called Akromia. According to the government, Akromia armed the militants, it gave the orders, and it was responsible for the deaths of Uzbek citizens in Andijan. Akromia was a menace that had to be stamped out at any cost. There was one problem with that theory, and Akromia, according to Uzbek and international human rights groups, political organizations, journalists, citizens, and accused Akromia members themselves, the organization did not exist. The Uzbek government had invented Akromia, which became the all-purpose label slapped on any Uzbek who dared to dissent. Sarah Kendzior believes that just as the Uzbek government invented the boogeyman Akromia to justify the brutal suppression of dissent, Donald Trump is using the label Antifa to do the same, to suppress and criminalize the rising resistance against his fascist regime in the United States. Kendzior knows a lot about the myth of Akromia because she's the one who debunked it. So we're very pleased to have her with us today on Law and Disorder. Sarah Kendzior is the best-selling author of The View from Flyover Country, Hiding in Plain Sight, and They Knew. Her latest book, The Last American Road Trip, was published this year, and I had the pleasure of reviewing it, favorably, I might add, for Ms. Magazine. From 2018 until 2023, she was the co-host of Gaslit Nation, a weekly podcast, and she is well known for her coverage of the Trump administration and for writing about authoritarianism, kleptocracy, transnational organized crime, racism and xenophobia, and other issues like voting rights, technology, the environment, and corruption. Sarah holds a PhD in anthropology from Washington University in St. Louis and an MA in Central Eurasian Studies from Indiana University. In August 2013, Foreign Policy Journal named her one of the 100 people you should be following on Twitter to make sense of global events. Sarah, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you for having me.
As a graduate student in an Indiana University MA program, you published a paper, quote, Inventing Akromia, the Role of Uzbek Propagandists in the Andijan Massacre. You published it in a peer-reviewed academic journal, but your paper got banned from Uzbekistan and it angered some U.S. think tanks. Tell us what you learned about the invention of Akromia, the reaction to your paper in Uzbekistan and in the United States, and what your research reveals about how authoritarian governments need to invent a public enemy to repress the opposition and try to turn the general public against the resistance.
Yes, thank you. So I began to write this paper shortly after the massacre in Andijan, which was in May 2005. And as you said, I was a graduate student at Indiana University, originally intending to carry out my research in Uzbekistan. After that massacre, Uzbekistan banned basically all Western journalists, human rights researchers, activists, you know, even tourists from coming to Uzbekistan. And I had to change the focus of my research. So I mostly switched to, you know, historical matters, but I was still very upset about what had happened in Andijan. And I was reading a lot of the coverage of it while doing this other research on how the Uzbek government defined basically what was Islamic terrorism, because that was their boogeyman. That was the trope that they would pull out to say, you know, that people didn't have the right to assemble, to protest, and so on. They would label anybody who would do that a terrorist. And so, you know, as I was doing this research, you know, into Acromia, the group that they had blamed, I found the original document that the government said was written by the leader of Acromia, a man named Akram Yudolshev. And this is back before Google Translate. The whole thing was in Uzbek. I was studying Uzbek, so it took many months, but I managed to translate about 9,000 word book and found that nothing in it that the government had said was in it was there. You know, they said there was this elaborate plan to commit terrorism against the government. It was in multiple stages. It was all laid out. They had the proof. They had reason to jail him. They had reason to jail all of his contemporaries. None of it was in there. So the fact that very few Westerners spoke Uzbek was a real point in their favor. And the fact that a lot of think tanks were falling in line with the Uzbek government because they found having a relationship with Uzbekistan very advantageous during the quote-unquote war on terror was also a point in their favor. So when I published this paper debunking not just what was in that particular text, but also in the texts of Uzbek state propagandists and their Western lackeys, you know, and showing that this group did not in fact commit any kind of action that would warrant a massacre of civilian protesters, a lot of people got mad at me, you know, and I was 26 or so, so I didn't really know how all this stuff worked with think tanks in Washington and stuff. But, you know, I got the Hudson Institute mad, you know, a few Central Asia institutes that got funding from the military. I got some of the people in the U.S. military angry, though not all. There were some in the U.S. government that actually were on the side of the protesters. You know, notably, John McCain was one who defended the protesters. He's not someone I saw eye to eye with a lot, so I did appreciate that. But yes, of course, I got banned from Uzbekistan. The paper got banned from Uzbekistan. This is no great feat. It's very easy to get banned from Uzbekistan, especially in the year 2005. Years later, though, on Twitter, the daughter of Islam Karimov, Gulnara Karimova, this sort of socialite, fashionista, wannabe autocrat heir, came after me on Twitter because of this paper, threatening me and so forth. So, you know, the paper lived on. What I didn't expect was that 20 years later, I would be bringing this paper up again to discuss the host of Celebrity Apprentice who had gone on to be the aspiring autocrat of the United States, and that now Americans are facing, you know, many of the same conditions that Uzbeks have always faced in Uzbekistan. And I want to stress that we're nowhere near where Uzbekistan was and is. You know, we still have the right to speech, to free assembly, and so forth, but they are deeply threatened. And this creation of Antifa, or whatever they're calling it, I always think of it as antifad, because it's literally like anti-fascist, because they're pro-fascist. You know, it's just another step, and it was just so familiar to me, the way that they were creating this mythical terrorist, you know, that needed to be banned and could justify all sorts of regulations, that I wrote a paper called Inventing Antifa. And honestly, it just makes me sad that we're in this position where 20 years later, we are headed in the direction of Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan has remained an authoritarian state, and the whole world is taking this, you know, hard right-wing turn.
Sarah, in September 2025, Trump declared Antifa a terrorist organization through an executive order. On No King's Day, you wrote that you were, quote, afraid that Antifa is the American Acromia, a fabricated entity made by state propagandists to persecute anyone who opposes the government. Please describe the origins of the actual Antifa movement, why the Trump administration sees it as a threat, and why you do fear it's becoming the American Acromia.
Well, the reason I fear it's becoming the American Acromia is because Acromia was defined in extremely broad, vague terms until they found it useful. You know, until there was this mass protest in Andijan and they needed to fire on the protesters, and after there was this massacre of protesters, they needed some sort of excuse. They needed a pretext for it. Before that, Acromia had been defined so loosely that when members were accused of being in it, they had absolutely absolutely no idea what the movement was. And then when they were told, you know, this is the movement of Akram Yudolshev, you know, the evil terrorist, they would start laughing because Akram Yudolshev was a businessman, who wrote this kind of freewheeling tract called The Road to Faith that, you know, it sounds like a self-help guide. Like, it's very innocuous. It has nothing to do with terrorism or violence. And I think with Antifa, they have never been, it doesn't exist in the sense that it doesn't exist as a coherent movement with coherent goals, leadership, organization, weaponry, plans. There are, you know, millions, tens of millions of Americans, I think the majority of Americans, who are anti-fascist, as in they do not want the United States to become a fascist regime because it is bad and oppressive to have a fascist regime or to live under one. And that is something that all Americans have learned since World War II. And this sudden turn where to be pro-fascist is considered the patriotic way is something that Trump and his goons are trying to convince everyone is normal. But it's really unprecedented for a mainstream political movement, especially the one holding executive office, to have this belief. And so Trump, you know, has defined in this executive order, you know, a very, very loose definition of what can get you called a member of Antifa, you know, anti-capitalist, anti-Christian, extremism on race, extremism on gender. Like, what does extremism mean? What does it mean to be anti? If I say capitalism often hurts people and exploits them, like, am I anti that, or am I just making a common sense critique? You know, if I say I believe women should have equal rights, am I an extremist on gender? Like, where is the extremism? They don't define any of this. And that is very similar to what the Uzbek government did with both Akromia, but also when they would talk about Islamic extremists in general. You know, Islamic extremists went from people who actually were in organized religious extremist groups with doctrine and leaders and so forth, to any man who had a long beard who resembled what they would call a Wahhabi, referring to the Saudi Arabian clerics. Anybody who just looked the part was suddenly labeled an Islamic extremist, especially if that person was a dissident, especially if they were in the political opposition, especially if they wrote an editorial that made someone mad. They'd find some trait or quality in that Uzbek individual and say, Islamic extremists were putting you in prison. And what was very sad to see is they had the support of a lot of Western countries in doing that, because those countries were fighting their own illicit, quote unquote, wars on terror, you know, picking up innocent people and putting them in Guantanamo and not getting them legal representation until well after the fact. And a lot of those individuals ended up being cleared of charges. And so there's a great similar danger here that many Americans may be scooped up off the street, accused of things they did not do, accused of being in a group that they are not in or even familiar with, and imprisoned. We've already seen what ICE has been doing, and I think that this is something that Trump would prefer the military to carry out, and whether they're willing to do that remains to be seen.
Sarah, tell us about the dangerous concept of pre-crime embodied in Trump's National Security Presidential Memorandum 7, referred to as NSPM-7. And why journalist Ken Klippenstein has called it, quote, a declaration of war on anyone who does not support the Trump administration and its agenda.
Yeah, Ken Klippenstein has done very good work on this, on, you know, deconstructing this memo, and he rightly compares it to, you know, the movie Minority Report, in which people were arrested for pre-crime, you know, for just thinking of an attack or, you know, being a possible suspect in a future attack that has not actually happened and may not ever take place. And so, you know, this is something that the Bush administration certainly not even flirted with. They really inaugurated through the idea of preemptive war and preemptive strikes. We're now seeing that being used against our own citizens here in the United States instead of being directed abroad. And again, because the terminology that they use is so vague, it would be easy for them to get law enforcement to arrest people on just very spurious grounds. And another thing I worry about is social media, because, you know, that's a routine part of American life. Most Americans hold a social media account. We are increasingly seeing AI used to summarize what people are saying instead of people's own words standing on their own. So it would be easy for them to, one, use AI as a way of mass surveillance and spying, but also there's not some, you know, group of individuals sorting through texts trying to figure out if any of them actually pose a violent threat. They could just have AI do that, and AI makes mistakes. AI lies. AI gets basic information wrong. AI cannot be relied upon to run any kind of military endeavor, you know, certainly not at the point that it's at. I mean, I don't think it's a good idea at all, ever, to have robots deciding who gets freedom and who does not. But I think at this point, it's downright dangerous. But you see this investment in AI companies and in this kind of technology, and it's really combining a lot of the worst aspects of, you know, modern technology with authoritarian government, you know, which makes them possible to carry out what was truly a sci-fi scenario 20 years ago, you know, reflected in movies like Minority Report.
Sarah, you have written about Trump's threat to use the RICO, Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, against Antifa and those accused of providing support for Antifa. What threats does that pose to freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and the right to protest and dissent?
It poses a great threat. It's tremendously ironic because this is what Trump and the gang surrounding him have been running from their entire lives, you know, since the day that he was under the tutelage of mafia lawyer Roy Cohn, you know, Roy Cohn, who was always battling RICO, and RICO was applied on his clients. And so Trump is very familiar with RICO. He's not familiar with RICO in the way I would prefer him to be familiar with RICO, as in, you know, charged under it, but he knows how it works. And most importantly, the lawyers surrounding him know how it works. And they know how it can be abused. And so if they're going to now go beyond saying that people who oppose this government are terrorists and now put them in the category of criminals and organized crime, he can do that while also watering down the definition of what RICO is itself and what it can be used for. You know, if the tables were to ever turn and, you know, Trump or others surrounding him were to be charged under RICO dictates, you know, I wonder how that would be interpreted, because it would just seem to be almost a, you know, a meaningless law at this point. And I think that's part of their goal, is like the dissolution of RICO, to have it not stand as a forceful tool to battle organized crime. It took a long time for RICO to get codified in law. You know, the CAFEVA hearings about organized crime were held in the early 1950s. RICO didn't get passed, I think, until about 71. You know, it took about 20 years, because organized crime does not want to get indicted. You know, organized crime is often white collar crime. It's often what people just call politics, what they just call business. And a lot of very powerful individuals can be taken down by this particular set of laws. So I think they would much rather be using those laws against the people who want to take them down. So I also wouldn't be surprised if, you know, congressmen or other judges and so forth are the ones that they're suddenly hitting with spurious RICO charges.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Steve Rohde, and I'm joined by my co-host, Heidi Boghossian. Today, we're speaking with Sarah Kendzior, the author of a popular newsletter, and herself a journalist and author, focusing on issues of authoritarianism, crime, racism, and technology. Sarah, you have written, quote, "As authoritarian regimes consolidate, they become more insular and paranoid, and their net widens. Consider how in an age of digital surveillance, an offhand remark can lead to bracelets behind your back." Are you concerned that that's what is happening or is emerging in the United States under Trump?
Oh, yeah. You know, and I don't think that Trump is the mastermind of any of these policies. You know, I think it's ideologues like Miller or Bannon or others that come up with them. But he does have the classic tendency of an autocratic ruler, which is as they age and as they retain power, in his case, they begin a second term of power after being out of power, but also being unpunished and still building his operation, you know, while Biden was in office, they do become more insular. They become more paranoid. They become more desperate to hold on to what they have. You know, Trump's case is a little bit interesting because the circle tends to become very narrow. You know, his first term was emblematic of that, where you saw people that Trump had worked with his entire life, usually, you know, at the periphery or sometimes the center of crime, people like Roger Stone, Paul Manafort, and so on, were the people that were advising him throughout his administration. Now we have this much younger crowd because they know Trump is almost 80 years old. I think they're trying to train, you know, heirs to this political process. My fear is that their overall goal is the dissolution of the United States and basically stripping it for parts, you know, partitioning it into separate nations, basically following the model of what happened to the Soviet Union, but then in particular, the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, where oligarchs could just loot and steal resources and, you know, call it hyper-capitalism, and there was no law at all to contain them. I think that that is their dream. I think they'll do that whether we're being, you know, partitioned or whether they actually are going to have a fully fascist society. I honestly thought, you know, Trump was kind of too lazy to pursue a fully fascist society, but his ideologues seem more serious about it. And I think one of the reasons they're more serious about it is because of digital advancements. And like I said, they can now rely on AI. They don't have to do the hard work of assembling a mass of, you know, surveillance operatives and spies. You know, if you look at a traditional authoritarian state like Uzbekistan, you know, that was one of the largest sectors, was domestic spies or the militia, getting a network of informants, getting people to inform on their neighbors regularly. Now people, they can just look at your phone. You know, they can just look at what you write online. They can look at all these technological gadgets that people voluntarily give personal information to, sometimes just for fun because they don't know the dangers of it, often because they have to, because it's part of their job. It's part of their ability to connect with relatives or with doctors or, you know, other things that they need to do. So I'm not blaming people for this. I think it's really terrible that society is being designed in a way where we're increasingly losing the ability to opt out. And that's true whether you see updated versions of software in which it automatically goes to AI, you know, and has AI scanning all of your work and sending it back, or things like QR codes where you have to have your phone on hand to be admitted into a store or a restaurant and be able to, you know, read a menu or purchase things. Society should not work this way. You know, we should be able to move freely without anybody having the capacity to surveil us if that is what we choose. And that's how I try to live my life, but I find it increasingly difficult. You know, and I'm living it because I expect authoritarianism to become much stronger in this country, and I'm trying to get ahead of the game. You know, the irony, of course, is that I write articles on the internet, so I don't think I'm going to win this game. I think I'm in a bit of trouble, but I would like in my recreational time at least to be free of this. And I certainly encourage Americans whose job does not depend on the internet, you know, to try to break yourself free of your phone dependencies and so forth as much as possible.
Sarah, you have also written that, quote, there are no fixed definitions in a mafia state. Law is a plaything. Evidence is an illusion. And as an Uzbek dissident explained to me 20 years ago in a way I now understand far better, quote, suspicious is the same as guilty. How far do you fear Trump is capable of going if left unchained?
Well, I think it's not just Trump. It's this broader network that surrounds him, which is the network of a mafia state. And I do think they will go as far as they want when it comes to hanging on to power, resources, money, territory, you know, all of the things that, you know, an authoritarian leader and their backers traditionally crave. I think we also have a variety of ideologues in his midst. We have religious fanatics. We have techno-fascists, which I'm very frightened about. So you have a lot of different people who normally wouldn't necessarily overlap, wanting different things and using Trump as a bulldozer to this aim. I used to always use this metaphor, and then of course he literally put a bulldozer through the east wing of the White House. So now I don't know if I should change things up, but you know, that's how he's operated for a long time. He was not the person who came up with the ideas. He was the front man. That's how he also operated before he became the president, when he was really a front man for organized crime in New York. And he was always at the least adjacent to those circles, and often, you know, working directly with them, with people like, you know, Felix Sater from Bayrock and others who have, you know, established ties to organized crime networks. And so anyway, I'm not sure there are limits as to how they'll go. I think there's a tremendous element of sadism, and the speed at which they've acted has surprised me. And I think it's in some sense because they want to sate that kind of sadist impulse within them. I think they genuinely like to see Americans suffer. They like to see migrants suffer. They see this as an act of revenge, because I thought, you know, the media was quite accommodating of Trump, and God knows the court system was, the DOJ was under Merrick Garland. You know, they let him get away with sedition. They ignored the Mueller report, which was, you know, delivered to them on a silver platter. There are so many things he could have been charged for, and his backers and partners, and they just weren't. And then all the other seditionists were allowed to remain in Congress. And that's unprecedented in world history. You know, even Hitler went to prison in between his putsch and his presidency. There's never been an unpunished seditionist who was allowed to run for president again. So I kind of feel like this was already decided long ago, that there would be no meaningful opposition to Trump, that for whatever reason, what should be the opposition was going to let him run wild and abuse the citizens of this country and abuse their rights and rewrite it through things like these executive orders. What's interesting to me is that now I think we see clear pushback. He's never been a popular president. The media has always exaggerated his popularity. But, you know, in the election results, in the No Kings rallies, in the other rallies, you know, that don't get as much press attention but happen all the time, against authoritarianism, concerning other human rights issues, we've seen steady pushback. People don't like this administration, and people who voted for it the second time have changed their minds. And whether that actually is able to get them out, I'm not sure. Because, you know, dictators are dictators for a reason. Like they have to be dictators because they're not popular. They have to have coups because they lose elections, and they don't have any shame in doing this, because in their view, the law is whatever they say it is, and that's the beginning and the end of the law.
You've written there are a multitude of ways to derail authoritarianism, and we need all of them. As we come to a close, what can you tell our listeners they can do to derail the Trump MAGA authoritarianism?
Well, there's a multitude of ways, because there's a multitude of people. So I just encourage people to pursue whatever they're interested in, whatever they're best at, whatever they're good at, you know, and operate locally. If everyone is operating locally at a cause that they're passionate about, that creates a great result. I mean, this can be environmental activism, you know, civil rights, election rights, you know, so on, whatever you choose. If you're looking for something broader, one thing that's missing that we did have the first Trump term is documentation. We're seeing a real effort of the Trump administration to rewrite history, erase history. You know, now they're going after even the web archive. The FBI is pursuing that. They're trying to erase our recent history because they don't want a record of what they did. And so one thing everyone can do is to just simply write things down, print out articles or save articles that you think are valuable. And hopefully we could do this in a more organized fashion, where we could create some sort of collective record of our times. That's something that's always been useful for people who've lived under authoritarianism, especially once the dictator is gone, because it allows them to rebuild society. It's something to work towards, and it helps facilitate a greater understanding of how we got to this place to begin with.
Thank you very much for being with us today, and the Clarion Call, your newsletter and your writing produces for everyone in the United States. Thanks again.
Oh, thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section, when Dad injured his back, when your basketball star tore his ACL. Opioids helped with the pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Opioids are powerful, pain-reducing prescription medicines. But most people who are prescribed opioids don't finish their prescriptions. So millions of unused opioids are sitting in homes across the country. And tragically, more than 100 Americans die every day from overdoses involving opioids. What can you do to protect your family? Remove the risk of unused opioids from your home. Pills, patches, or syrups in drawers, purses, and cabinets. Anywhere they might be hiding. To find out how to dispose of them properly, visit www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with historian Paul LeBlanc on the tremendous socialist victory of Zoran Mandani in the race for mayor in New York City.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.